and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all of the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Hannah Burrows, who's doing a PhD in psychology under the supervision of Dr. Valerie Kuhlmeier. Welcome to Grad Chat, Hannah.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and I'm really excited to dive into your research because it sounds super cool. But before we get into it, can you tell us a little bit about what attracted you to Queen's in the first place?
That's a great question. I've been here forever. People say I'm like the ancient Queen's person in our department, but I did my undergraduate research here, my master's work, and now my PhD.
Okay, very nice. So I
definitely started off being attracted to Queen's. I grew up in Ottawa, but from the research perspective, there were so many opportunities in the psychology department that made me really excited. My first thesis was in autism and ADHD, and I worked in the autism spectrum disorders lab, and I just fell in love with the research process. It was so stimulating, and I got to actually work with dogs in my third year with the First Many Dogs Project, which is a global consortium of researchers across the world doing the same research, trying to figure out the differences in culture across different dog human populations. And from there, I was like, I need to study dogs. This is amazing. I can't believe I get paid to do this. It's awesome.
So your research currently is understanding dog-human relationships by linking guardian beliefs with real-time dog-guardian behavior to improve animal welfare and everyday interactions. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that looks like, what that means?
Yeah, so I guess I could backtrack a little bit to just describe my master's work. Yeah. So it kind of laid the foundation for what I want to do in my PhD. So first thing I did, I developed a survey, which is called PUPS.
That's great.
Yeah, thank you so much. A lot of iterating just on that part of the research, but it stands for the Perception of Undesirable Pet Behavior Survey. So a lot of the work that's been done in dogs prior is not super naturalistic, and it doesn't really generalize when we're looking at how people perceive their dogs and if that's a self-fulfilling prophecy or not to the types of behavior that show up in the different areas that you are. So our idea was looking at how can we first contextualize it? So if I have an issue with my dog and I tell someone I have a bad dog or my dog is poorly behaved, it doesn't really tangibly provide a great example for a person that can help you in that situation. So the idea with this research was sort of looking at, okay, we can survey people. And through the survey, what did we get, right? Like, what are those areas where we can work on our dog's behavior, but also be more cognizant as the person that probably is impacting it a little bit more than even the dog, right? It's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So we ended up finding four different areas. So it was like public behaviors, training behaviors, fear and distress or anxiety, and then home-related behaviors. And from this, I actually had a two-part study basically for my master's. With the PUPS research, we were able to take the PUPS into real life. So when you're approaching a difficult situation, say there's food on the ground and you don't want your dog to eat it, what actually happens? So that was the second portion. We had people come into the lab and we did actual like real-time behavioral data, and that was what basically like started all of our interest around this.
And then with your PhD work, where are you headed now with this project?
Yeah, so based on this, some of the findings we found that are pretty interesting that I want to dive into a little bit more are there's different beliefs that obviously predicted different guardian behaviors. So the guardians who are actually more worried or fearful about their dog's behavior, regardless of however the dog acted, were actually more likely to disengage when they actually needed to like provide context or scaffolding for the dog to understand why the behavior was bad or not. So that's super interesting. It could be its whole like side study if we wanted to do that. And another one was looking at dogs of more concerned guardians actually spent more time monitoring the food. So they actually spent like less time sort of like looking at their guardian or like watching them attentively. So there's some training implications there, which I'm really interested in. And it's a bit of a segue into what I want to do for my PhD, which is working with working dog populations. So there's so many different types of like working dog relationships. Like, there's endangered species detection. Mm. So some people go and train dogs to collect scat, and then we can use that scat so we don't have to actually capture endangered species and understand the dynamics ecologically of those populations. I'm really interested in working with more applications that have to do with, like, seeing guide dogs, police work. We just did a really big survey in our lab, which is over 500 police dog trainers and handlers across the world.
Wow.
And looking at what they need us researchers to provide them. And really interesting research questions that came out of that paper as well. So excited to dive into those
things. Okay, so you've got lots of avenues on the go for your PhD, it sounds like, and all about understanding that human-dog relationship or dog-guardian relationship. Is that looking, like you mentioned working dogs, but your master's work was with pets as well, right? So you're looking at both pets and dogs who are working, but might be pets in their downtime, I guess, is how to say that.
Yeah, and like, I think people think, especially in a North American context, like our relationship with dogs is obviously very different in a Western cultural context. Also, like, primarily we call it like weird in psychology, where it's like Western, like educated, industrialized. So there's, I think it's around like 20% or something of the global dogs in the world are companion animals, and the rest are also wild.
Mm.
So there's also like really interesting implications for like wild dog research that I really want to look into as well. Like there's different contexts. Like for example, in Bali, there's like kind of this like middle ground between like a companion versus a working dog, where like the dogs kind of just coexist with people. And they had a really bad feral dog population sort of problem where a lot of the dogs were really sick. But within their culture there, a lot of the offerings people would provide every morning ended up being more things the dogs could eat rather than just food that they had left out that maybe made dogs sick, and people were a little bit more responsive to that. And now I think they're almost at like 90% of dogs there that are like completely healthy.
Wow.
Which is like totally just a mindset of like a cultural change in a different environment. So yeah, there's really interesting like the differences between companion animals and working dogs. But I'm really, my thing is looking at like how we can best teach people to understand dogs and how can that work in a working context, but also completely transferable to a companion animal.
Oh, that's really cool. Because I mean, like you said, in kind of a Western, a weird setting, as they call it, dogs are everywhere. So
yeah,
there's a lot of applications or potential applications for your work. What originally drew you to studying dog and human relationships?
Yeah, so I briefly mentioned this, but I'll totally shout out Many Dogs because I think it's a really cool thing. So I'm not sure how much you're aware of the replication crisis that happened in psychology, but it's been like a couple decades now of people trying to replicate, not really seeing this, like, I would say, like, seminal research papers that have been published, and people kind of saying, oh, I don't know how much we're really, how much this is transferable across different cultures or contexts, for example. So there's been this global movement of, like, the Many, Many Project.
Okay.
So there's, like, many babies, many otters, many dogs. And the first many dog study was near the end of my undergrad. So very, very new research. But I got to actually take part in that, which was really cool. So our lab collected data, and I'm pretty sure there was something like 30 labs across the world. And we all did the same study. And then we all looked at, like, what are the differences there? Because ultimately, like, there's a lot of places doing the same research, which is amazing. But then we're publishing findings that, like, can be contradictory or just may not really replicate across different samples, but we're saying they're generalizable. So it's, like, really helping people hold ourselves accountable as researchers, which I find really awesome. And getting to do that work, I really, it's basically that project is looking at how do dogs respond to cueing and how we point. Because they have a really specific, really interesting way of like communicating with people, much better than a lot of different species. So that project, I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. Basically, my job was just holding a dog and like telling them to move around. And I was like, this cannot be research. Like, I feel very lucky. So as a dog person myself, I got really excited in it and wanted to keep doing it.
And then that led to your master's work. And now you're continuing to expand that in your PhD work.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah, completely.
And you mentioned this already about kind of how it's going to build a little bit on some of the work you've already done. Could you tell us a bit more like specifically about how your PhD research is going to build on your master's research? Like you did two studies in your master's. Are you planning a few studies in your PhD? Like what will it look like?
Yeah, so I wanted to shout out Dr. Tom Hollenstein, who's in the psych department. His work is specifically looking at developmental research, so between, like, usually dyadic stuff, which is totally, like, person-dog or dog for me, but he does, like, maternal-child sort of conflicts and things like that. So he has developed and really honed this methodology called the state space grid.
Okay.
So it's a way to visualize, like, the places that people get stuck in conversationally in terms of, like, do you really stick in this area? Where's the pain point between these two people? And there's a lot of really cool quantifiable ways to look at it. So this method also provides a visual view of it, which is pretty cool because then you can see, like, also what you're describing. It's never been used with animals before.
Okay.
So what we're trying to do at the moment is taking my master's work and trying to decipher how to put that into a state space grid so we can visually see, like, where do dogs and people get hung up on when they're in this sort of challenging situation? And can we pinpoint those parts? And with dogs especially, like, obviously there's a power dynamic compared to two humans having a conversation. But it'll be interesting to see, like, how much, kind of that helicopter parenting approach. Like, if I have this view of my dog before I go into a situation, and am I just not proactively, am I proactively impeding my dog from interacting and learning in a way that I also think might be helping them? And can we, like, actually visually see, like, okay, at 30 seconds in this interaction, that's when you didn't really provide your dog the context to move forward or understand or learn from the situation? So that's the first step with that. And then trying to take that tool into hopefully, like, a veterinarian context or a working dog context, or when we select dogs for different training, for example, like PTSD with veterans. There's so many places that, like, we use dogs as tools, really, but we don't really look at, like, how to best train or really select from the person side and the dog side.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So from this, the state space type of method, when you were describing your master's work with dogs approaching food and then seeing how that would go, would that look something like, I mean, this is all ideal once you've mapped it on the method, but it would be like, okay, we see, say, an anxious guardian who's already worried about their dog eating something they found in this context, in a research context, but, you know, they found on a walk or something, and they start to, you know, at 15 seconds, they start to tense up, and at 20 seconds, the dog realizes and then also starts to look more at the food instead of the person. Or is that the kind of thing that you would be able to map 100%. Using the state space method? Okay.
Yeah. I think the other cool thing is, like, that's totally at the individual level, super interesting and informative. But when we're looking at, like, we had 111 dogs and people come in for just my master's, the in-person portion.
Wow, that is a lot of data to work with.
A lot of data. And the pups, we had, like, over 600.
Wow.
Yeah, so with looking at that, that's really interesting as a generalizable population just in Kingston. What are the tendencies and can we group those, right? Say, like, around this one particular point in time, when we kind of code, we don't really see those things. We can kind of decipher, like, a relationship, but visually seeing, oh, 40% of our sample that is real, that 40% that when we look at pups, like, they're super anxious. In the first 20 seconds, they actually don't even let their dog, like, sniff anything, for example. That's just a super, like, extreme example.
Or, like, what you could see, or what themes you could pull out from that visual.
Yeah, which is cool.
Well, and that would, I mean, I guess it'll have to, you'll have to wait and see what the method reveals to you, but that could tell you a lot of different things to move forward with.
It's kind of tangential, but even with this type of research, there's so many different, like, ways to analyze it. Like, what we kind of did was looking at basically just behavior. We're looking at coding it on a continuous scale. But I'm really interested in looking at people's voice changes and how much, like, they even gender their dog. There was so many different versions of people that actually were way... their people that had their dogs that were more attentive to them used gendered language towards their dog.
Oh, interesting.
And just, like, super random finding that, like, could be its own study, like, which is cool too.
Well, it sounds like you have a lot of really rich, robust data just from your previous work, and then you're about to build on this as well and build this really new kind of novel data set. Well, sets of data, I guess, not even just one, but all these sets of data to be able to work with into the future as well, hopefully, and other folks as well.
Yeah, we're really excited about that. I think, too, like, a lot of this work prior has been really informative, but not necessarily supernaturalistic, which has been a critique of, like, just impulsivity research with dogs, but also how do you sort of decipher, like, what impulsivity is, right? Like, it could be, like, is my dog super reactive and jumpy? Or, like, is my dog, is it only around squirrels, like, food? How much can you contextualize it to help somebody understand their dog better? And the kind of the implications of this, too, are, like, a lot of dogs were adopted during the pandemic, but a lot were relinquished right when people were starting to go back to work. Mm-hmm. Because behaviorally, they were, like, a huge change happened between everybody's lives. And they kind of got this companion animal thinking that this would be a good relationship. And then when behavioral things started coming up, when people got more social, a lot of people, there's like millions of dogs that got relinquished across North America.
Yeah.
So there's also like implications just for people to better be more responsible dog owners, but also like be more cognizant about that relationship with the animal when we decide to take it into our care as well.
Well, and of course, I mean, if you describe it, like if you were to put a human in the context of a dog who was adopted during COVID, if you're like, oh, you met a new friend, they came to live with you as a roommate, and you spent 24/7 together during lockdown, and then suddenly you had to go back to work, but the roommate was no longer able to interact with you or anyone else while you were gone all day at work.
Yeah.
Of course, there will be behavioral changes. And then if you, you know, apply that back to a dog, of course, it makes sense that there's lots. I mean, that's earth-shattering for the dog,
even,
right?
Even, so. Like, breed-wise, right? Like, some people think, like, oh, I got this dog because it's really cute. But, like, that breed was made to be, like, chasing sheep 24/7 out on, like, 17 acres of land in Scotland, right? Like, it's a really specific way of, like, viewing a dog. But all those things, context-wise, are so important to understanding our dog's behavior.
Yes, much more than cuteness.
So. Exactly.
So how do you think this research could eventually support everyday dog owners with companion animals or professionals with working dogs?
Yeah, I think a main thing I really wanted to look at for my master's was like removing the potential label of a problematic dog, especially when their guardian or owner is a person that you could tell just like, when people would come in, sometimes they'd be like, oh, my dog is like so poorly trained. And then you sort of watch them interacting and it's like, you don't really give your dog a chance sometimes too. And also it's usually like it's a two-way street. Like they say, like there's a really interesting paper that is like stress runs from both sides of the leash. Like dogs tend to be like quite big mirrors, even like physiologically, like with cortisol, stress, anxiety, depression. Like I think to better inform people to understand that like dogs are really intertwined in our lives, probably more than we even notice, because it's one of those things like when you haven't seen somebody for a long time, you're like, you look different. Like when you're living with them all the time, it's a completely different relationship. But the idea, especially with pups, was looking at like a more context-based measure of, can we pinpoint those pain areas? Is there a way to better perform like a very quick and dirty version of what's your issues? And then can we train that way? Can we help you feel more confident, right? Because ultimately, we're just looking at beliefs and how beliefs affect behavior. And it shouldn't be that big of a deal, but obviously, given our current political climate and how the world is, I think it's a very interesting time to look at how much do we believe and how does that impact how we act, right? And like, I can say one thing, but the next day I can do a completely different thing, right? Those things don't really always, they're not always set in stone. So I think researching how we believe and what we think about our animals is really important to inform how to actually train them. And that's kind of the idea of like bridging science with also like everyday pet ownership.
Oh, that's really interesting. And it's, I don't know, this is totally anecdotal from my personal experience, but I like dogs. I don't have it my own dog, but I'm not good at setting boundaries with dogs, and I find that my friends' dogs know that immediately, and they will push they'll put, you know, if they're, for example, if a dog isn't supposed to jump on someone and they know that, well, they come to me, they jump on me right away because they know I'm not going to stop them, right? Like I'm like, oh, you're so cute, you know. So they push the boundary because they get a sense right away that my belief about them is that it's okay and I'm not gonna, like, maybe, I don't know, punish or, you know, stop that behavior is the same thing. So dogs usually push limits with me that they wouldn't with their owners, because I think they can sense right away that I'm the weakest link.
Or the best one, right? Yeah. And it's like, that's the thing. It's totally based up to perception. Mm-hmm. Like somebody, there's a really interesting paper that kind of, I would say like it inspired this work and then we took it a totally different direction. But it was the first paper to look at pet parenting styles developed from human developmental parenting styles and looking at those differences in that relationship. I think they've only used it in one population. So again, replication crisis, take everything with a grain of salt. But they've basically found like there are patterns across, there are patterns across like if I'm authoritarian, how much my dog actually problem solves or like persists in a certain situation. Like things that I think when we talk about them may be more intuitive. But if I were to say like across the three different parenting styles, which do you think your dog would persist more? I don't think people would really know, right? Mm-hmm. So there's even how we tend to like own and like have this sort of power over the animal. Like it's definitely not, there's a power imbalance in that relationship. It's pretty interesting to think about like even how we say that we're acting and what we believe to be the case with parenting styles. It's kind of the same thing. Like I think some people may say they're more authoritative but end up being more authoritarian or permissive, for example. And it's totally up to that person's belief,
right? Oh, that's very, yeah. Well, I guess in the case of my friend's dogs, I am certainly a permissive permissive guardian in when I visit with friend's dogs, because, yes, they get away with it.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And so you're doing all of this really incredible work. And I know on top of that, you also keep really busy outside of the lab. Can you tell us a little bit about the textbook that you developed and what that was all about?
Yeah, definitely. So huge shout out to Dr. Megan Norris. She is the best. She's the undergraduate chair of psychology. She runs a course in fourth year for students. So you get the opportunity to TA Psych 100, which is awesome. But at the same time, she really challenges you in her whole sort of, there's an exam, but the main project through the course of the course is solving an issue with education.
Okay.
Super broad, right? It can be super daunting. But she really guides you in a way that, like, you think a lot, quite deeply about, like, what are some issues in education? And it could be higher education, it could be elementary. But with our group, we were like, okay, let's just go talk to people first. And we talked to a bunch of students. We surveyed 500 students on Queen's campus. And again, this is quite a privileged institution. Like, and still, like, the main pain point of every single student was money, paying for school across Canada. So when we realized that, we were looking into, like, okay, what are the ways that people can get money and funding? And we found that millions of dollars of scholarship money goes unclaimed every single year due to a lack of applicants. And there's just money that's left on the table.
Yeah.
So our solution there was creating a free open access textbook that we wrote, and each chapter basically walks you through like how to get a scholarship, how to do it safely, what are the aspects of applying to higher education that are beneficial to you, and how can you interact with that in a way that you can feel empowered. And we, each chapter has been expertly reviewed by somebody in that field, so it's like completely peer reviewed, and it's actually been published on the Queen's, so we have an ISBN, so it's a formally published resource. And through that, we have won the National Financial Literacy of Canada's month. They have a competition for students every year, but it was actually published on canada.ca too. That went into it. So a lot of it, we've had tens of thousands of people interact with the textbook, which is amazing. And we get people saying, like, I never thought I could go to school and I got a scholarship and it's changed my outlook on life.
Wow.
Like, it's very awesome. So I feel very, very privileged to be a part of that. But it's a very, very awesome thing that I always push, because it's called How to Pay for Post-Secondary. And it's through the eCampus project as well. So it's also like there's interactives. It's a fun, we have fun videos in there. Yeah, so it's awesome.
So if someone were to Google how to pay for post-secondary, that resource would come up from eCampus Ontario, and that's where to go.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, that is incredible. Yeah. And that, what an impact, both through your research, but just through your advocacy, your team came up with. And that's all before you even started grad school. That's incredible.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, it was the same time as my undergraduate thesis that I was writing. So a lot of writing, big writing here. Yes. But yeah, I feel like it's the gift that keeps giving, which is really awesome.
Yeah, no, I will definitely. I think I have seen this resource before, and I will definitely search it out now to share that with other folks when questions come in, because that is such a helpful thing. And like you said, like, you don't want to leave money on the table. But at the same time, if you are maybe a high school student or a mature student looking to come back to school, you don't know what you don't know. So until you're already here, how would you know about all these opportunities and scholarships and fellowships that could be relevant to you?
I think the other thing too, like, you totally hit the nail on the head there with, like, so many people that I would say, like, really merit and should feel that way do not have that self-confidence.
Mm.
So a lot of the work that we were doing in terms of, like, writing to actually empower students, mm-hmm. because, like, some of these people, like, they invented the soup kitchen. You look at their resume, mm-hmm. and you're like, how have you never applied to anything? Like, mm-hmm. you're a superstar. One of my co-authors has this really funny way of, like, describing, like, don't say you're a cashier, like, say that you managed, like, the funds of a multi-million dollar corporation, you know, like, which is, like, it's, like, we're totally swinging the extreme of that, but it's a good way to perceive mm-hmm. it, where, like, you have developed so many skills in your life, and why not you, you know, mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. totally reframe that. So that's a big part of the textbook as well, that I think more people should feel. And it's weird, like, people don't really talk about finances. Mm. It's kind of a sticky topic. Mm-hmm. I think generationally we're doing a little bit better in terms of, like, with social media and mm-hmm. things like that. But it still is this uphill battle that, like, especially for intersectionality, mm-hmm. like, women, like, a lot of groups that have never really seen people that have been successful in that. So we're currently collecting, like, it's kind of like snapshots from people that have won scholarships but represent a minority group.
Mm-hmm.
So we have different, basically, chapters that are coming out that are more like, this person looks like you. They've been able to do this. Like, feel empowered by mm-hmm. that. Because, again, like, I understand my own intersectionality, and, like, we want to uplift people that haven't seen people from their group or identity, which are totally out there.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to give them the microphone, you know?
Yeah, no, of course. And I think another, like, this theme keeps coming through your work about, like, belief, right? Of, like, what people, self-perception or their belief about themselves, that kind of where that belief is can either limit or open up opportunities for them. So it sounds like your textbook with your co-authors is about getting people to believe in themselves a little bit more while still showing them scholarship opportunities and things like that, but building that belief in so that they'll actually, you know, take that leap and apply and then hopefully find success.
Totally. Yeah. And, like, really reframing whatever we think about ourselves to, like, I think especially, like, these places want you to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they have it. So if you think that you don't merit it, like, it's really you're your biggest obstacle in this case. Mm. Worst case is that you don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, it's totally spaghetti at the wall in this world, you know? Like, it's kind of the same with research. Like, the amount of times that you'll think, like, oh, this is going to be something that's super significant, and then there's a totally different tangential thing. But you did the work to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the first step is always the most difficult, but the main thing people say is, like, oh, like, starting where I started, I feel better about myself, even if you don't get the first couple. Like, there's so many other opportunities to practice talking about yourself in a way that you're, like, you're selling yourself and, like, having, you're convincing yourself too that you merit that opportunity, which I think is really, really awesome.
No, that's super cool. So we'll have to get people to check that out.
Mm-hmm.
Check out the resource and see what options could be available to you.
Mm-hmm.
And outside of the textbook, you also do a lot of mentorship in the community as well. So I see this textbook as a great resource and opportunity for many people, but it sounds like you also offer more support in smaller groups or more in-person supports. Could you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, I've been a mentor through Queens, but also through this really awesome, I think it's like a Harvard-based non-for-profit called Lumiere. So they actually take the two students that I've worked through. One was a student that her parents actually had problems with ICE, and they were in Florida. And she, one of them was detained during the time that she was working, but, like, completely wrote a paper and got published.
Wow.
And was completely supported through that. And the student I'm currently working with is a refugee from the Ukrainian war. But they're fully funding the students, and then they get to work on a project, and I kind of co-supervise them. But it's really really fulfilling. I love that work. And with Queens especially, like, I get to supervise usually an undergraduate student that's working on something. It's like a little smaller chunk of my master's work, and then I get to help them through that process. My current student, Alex, is doing such a great job, and we actually just got into the Queens Women in Neuroscience Conference, which they host every year here.
Yeah.
And that's such a great conference. Like, I'm totally shouting them out because they're great. But yeah, it's a good opportunity for her to practice her work and to get to meet people as well. So I love that. It's really, really fulfilling.
So if people were interested in some of the research that you're doing or that your lab is doing, how could they get involved?
Yeah, so I live in the social cognition lab.
Okay.
So it's in psychology, but my work is in cognitive neuroscience as well. But through that, it's called like SEL Lab. And you can find us on Instagram, but also in the psychology department database, there's like all the labs, which is easy to find too. But we are looking for dog owners always to come in and volunteer. We usually give some treats and some toys, depending on the task. But we just started this work. So again, there's me and another PhD student, but we're completely building our database from the ground up. Like, I did this all last summer. And again, we got that 100 couple people, but we would love to have more people come in, and we want you guys to be represented more generally by the work that we're doing, but also it's a fun time. Like, my study essentially, like, you play with your dog, there's this kind of like challenging task, don't eat the treats, you get to eat the treats at the end, and then you play with your dog with toys at the end. So people really have a good time, and we get these funny emails where people email us like right afterwards, they're like, can I come in and do another one? And we're like, this took 7 months to set up, but yes. So yeah, we are really excited for people to come in and to contact us so we can add you into the database.
Oh, very cool. Well, Hannah, it has been great chatting with you. Thank you for doing the show, and the best of luck with the rest of your research.
Amazing. Thank you so much for having me.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. And until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.